WHUR-FM and HD1 Washington, along with a network of WHUR digital channels and WHUT present Money Talk, eliminating the black and white health gap. What is it going to take? Here's Harold Fisher.
What's in your wallet? What's in your purse? What is in your bank account? Are you saving? Are you investing? Or are you living paycheck to paycheck and can't seem to make any money moves beyond that? Good evening and welcome to our monthly special edition of The Daily Drum, another collaboration between 96.3 WHUR, HUR Voices, and WHUT-TV. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we have some money talk for you, eliminating the black-white wealth gap. What's it going to take? We're going to take the issue of financial literacy to a higher level, talking about everything from investing in real estate and the stock market to the cryptocurrency craze. As always, we have a great panel of experts to lead us through this topic. Of course, we will not be taking phone calls, but we invite you to join the conversation online using the hashtag MoneyTalk. Tonight's discussion will be streamed live on WHUR.com, Facebook, and YouTube. My guests are economist, author, and dean of the College of Ethnic Studies at California State University in Los Angeles, Dr. Julian Malveaux, Dr. Curtis Kidd-Telemach, director of the HPS Center for Financial Excellence at the Howard University School of Business, and wealth coach LaShawn Holland. Thank you all for joining in this conversation. I want to start with you, Dr. Telemach, if I may. Define what the black-white wealth gap is, and why does it still exist?
Yeah, sure. So the latter question, why does it still exist, is quite expansive. But exactly what it is that if we measure our net worth, right? And that will just be assets minus liabilities. We find that in the African American community, our net worth is significantly lower than our white counterparts. And that, in a nutshell, defines what the wealth gap is. And so if you start to peel back why that is, Let me just say, sort of as laconically as possible, the history of this country has been that most Americans were able to benefit from the economic prowess of the country, but there are a certain amount of Americans who were not able to. And in that amount, African Americans definitely are a part of that.
Dr. Malveaux, as it relates to the black-white wealth gap, why should African Americans care about competing against their white counterparts? Why can't African Americans just kind of focus on their own thing?
Wealth is like, number one, it's your adult report card. It's what you have. It's not what you cop. It's what you keep. But we know that we have... and of course, quoting the great philosopher, Lauryn Hill, it's not what you cop, it's what you keep. But what I want to say is that we have been prevented from keeping. In other words, there have been major impediments to our accumulating wealth, and that has been an issue. At the end of enslavement, in 1880, we had $1 for every $36 that white people had. By 1910, it was $1 for every $18 that white people had. In other words, in Reconstruction, we were able to build wealth. However, now, today, 2020, it's $1 for every $10 white people have. So we made more relative progress between 1880 and 1910 than we did 100 years later. Why is that? Because there have been many things that have prevented Black people from accumulating wealth. They include laws that excluded us from land granting opportunities. They included laws that redlined us out of our communities. In Washington, D.C., we see the gentrification that has sidelined Black people from home ownership and other things. We're not talking about competing with white people. I don't care about white people. What I care about is the ways that Black people have been prevented from accumulation. And the wealth gap conversation is about accumulation and abilities to accumulate. This conversation has become much more potent since George Floyd was murdered. And when we saw this white man with his knee on George Floyd's neck, what hit me as an economist was that white folks have had their knee on our economic neck since we got here. We have been unable to accumulate in ways that we could have. In my own personal family, we have the myth of the moving fence, where Massa gave us some land, and it was land that abutted a bayou, which was very fish rich. And so people would just come to the bayou and fish. One morning we woke up and found that the fence had moved. In other words, that the white folks decided those Negroes don't need to have that bayou. And years later, after two disappearing cousins and other things, the lane that leads down to the bayou is called Hawkins Lane, after my great-great-grandfather. And that was the city's concession to the fact that they stole our land. This is not a story, nor is my family a victim. This is a story that has happened over and over and over again. Whatever we accumulated, there were those who decided to keep us from accumulation. I know I'm talking a little long here, but let me just tell this one more story about Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells became involved in the Lynching Chronicles because she began to chronicle lynchings. The first one she chronicled was one of a friend of hers, Tommy Moss, who was a postmaster, deacon, and a number of other things in Memphis, Tennessee. He opened a store called the People's Grocery that was about a block away from a store that a white man owned. The white man, and I always forget his name, just deliberately almost, the white man was angry about economic competition. So when two little boys got into a fight over marbles, hear me, over marbles, white men went to the People's Grocery to confront Black people. Well, the brothers had guns. The brothers had guns. And so a couple of white men got shot. They didn't get killed, they got shot. A day later, the sheriff came and those three Black men were lynched. And then the white man was able to acquire their store, the People's Grocery, for 8 cents on the dollar. That's economic envy. That's economic envy. That's the root of the wealth gap. That's what we have to understand, is that when we accumulate too much, my mom, a tall nail will get beaten down. And any Black person who was a tall nail was beaten down.
Yeah. Let's make sure those phones are on silent, please, so that our listeners and our viewers can focus on this. I do want to, LaShawn, talk about where we are right now. Why do you believe that in many cases, African Americans are still living paycheck to paycheck, no matter how big those paychecks get?
Education. Simply, one of the things that we find at the Wealthy Leaders Institute, and we've been doing this for over three decades, it really is educating about the possibilities in the marketplace. People are lacking the education on really how to make their money work for them and how to put it to use in the market. I mean, we have so many different opportunities now, not only just in real estate, but we're in the quantum age of money where things are shifting. And yet the gap between who's in the market and who's not in the market, and then how we even show up in the market is still exists. So it's really one of the things that we really work hard at is closing this educational gap in the market.
But are they resistant to investing? Are they resistant to that education? This isn't, we don't have to go to the library anymore.
Absolutely.
The information is
there.
Is right here.
Absolutely.
So why are they so resistant to that?
It really does take a shifted mindset. Recently, I was in San Antonio, Texas, on the panel with one of the housewives, and she asked me, LaShawn, why do you think, Blacks aren't investing? And I said, well, your money has to be in the market instead of being in the mall. And so that really takes you having a mindset shift, one of accumulating assets and not just liabilities. And so it's important that we cultivate a growth mindset, right? Instead of doing the things that we normally have done in the marketplace with our money. But I do see hope with the next generation. You know, we see more people or more African-American millennials investing than we've ever seen before in history. And the same thing goes for Gen Z. And so I'm even seeing a shift in my clients from Gen Xers to millennials who are investing their money in the marketplace. So they're coming in, you know, by droves in our programs, and they're learning how to put their money to work for them. So yes, it does take a mindset shift, and it's not an easy mindset shift. But I also believe that a lot of it comes from programming during slavery and how we treated money back then, or how we didn't have any money. We wasn't given anything. But, you know, our parents didn't have crucial cash conversations with us growing up.
That was my next point. Before I go back to Dr. Telemark, there are so many ways to invest, as I mentioned, to grow income. How did you do it? How was there a shift in your mindset, or was it, or was the mindset handed down to you from your parents?
For investing, absolutely not. I mean, my story is my parents were teenagers when I was born, but, you know, I was blessed to have people put in my path that showed me what was possible. My degree is in accounting, and I remember working in an accounting department for a government contracting agency. And so I became very, very close with the owner of the company. And so she began to show me what was possible. And we started having the cash crucial conversations that I wasn't having at home. And not only not having at home, but nobody in my community, nobody in my church were talking about, you know, investing in gold and silver and commodities. Nobody, you know, was teaching me. Either other people on my job weren't, you know, really invested at that level. And so I just happened to have people that was placed in my path. And I was smart enough to start listening, not only it listening, but executing. And so that's really what shifted for me, was a trip that my boss, I took out to Las Vegas years ago, and I met a group of Black investors that were investing in commercial and residential real estate and commodities like gold and silver and titanium. And, you know, they were starting, they had businesses. And so they really start to show me the power of being able to multiply my money.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Telemark, what is your feeling about why so many African Americans may be resistant to investing? Certainly, the current stock market situation is not in any way, shape, or form encouraging for that kind of thing. But we are talking about, you know, long term. What is the hindrance, do you believe?
Yeah, so let us be clear here that in general, I would probably say that an overrepresentative amount of African Americans do not participate in the stock market, right? And so the reason that I want to lay sort of that sort of framework down is that I don't necessarily believe that most African Americans are apprehensive to it. We are currently conducting some studies out of the Center for Financial Excellence at Howard to actually pinpoint and quantify this sentiment. And so in general, just like my co-guest said before, we are seeing that in a different generation, a generation that is a little bit younger than myself, I should probably say a lot younger than myself, are moving toward investing as a sort of a part of their overall economic success argument. So that there's one, and I just want to lay that out there. Next, in general, there are a lot of our white counterparts, even though I know that Dr. Malvo said, I don't really care about the white people. So neither do I, but if we're gonna make a comparison, there are a lot of our white counterparts who had been introduced to the stock market in particular, just because they have maybe a pension plan or some sort of pension sort or 401k sort of plan from their current employment, of which two generations ago, we did not have the ability to participate in, right? So that could be a policeman or a fireman or some other blue collar sort of work that automatically sort of has you participate in the stock market, right? And so, and then the next thing that Dr. Malvo did mention was the history that we have in this country. And so you don't have to just invest, like LaShawn said, you don't have to just invest in stocks. It can be in some other asset, real estate being one. And the GI Bill was one bill that I can think of quickly off the top of my head that you can see the distinction there between those veterans that came back from World War II, I believe, who were able to participate and buy homes and utilize federal dollars to get homes in the real estate market, and those individuals who were not, particularly African Americans, and at that time, Chinese Americans, I believe, as well. And so then you can see a delineation between increasing their assets in one part of the country and not having the ability to increase those assets in the other.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Malvo, from a cultural standpoint, do you believe that the African Americans may have a hindrance to investing? We know there's that old saying, you want to drive good, you want to look good, you want to smell good, but the true wealth is in whether it's real estate, savings, investing. Do you believe that the feeling that we always have to represent our best self publicly is a hindrance to that?
Well, I think that, Harold, certainly that's a part of it, but I think also there have been major impediments to Black folks investing. So I don't think that I would say, okay, Black folks culturally don't want to invest, or Black folks spend too much money on their cars and on their homes. Let's look at what has happened with our homes. It's easier. Remember the John Johnson story about Ebony Magazine. He wanted to get a loan for the magazine. They said no. He went back and said he wants to take a vacation, and they said yes. So implicit bias often closed doors for Black people being able to invest in financial instruments. Let's look at banking. I mean, if we look at banking and the history of Black folks in banking, what we know is that we often couldn't even deposit money in the late 19th, early 20th century in banks. We had to do all kinds of other things. Sometimes we had to put it in white people's names who then stole it from us. So I always lift up the story of Magdalena Walker, the first Black woman to own a bank, the Penny Savings Bank in Richmond, Virginia, which became the Consolidated Savings Bank. To date, it's the longest running Black-owned bank. It's no longer Black-owned. It was taken over during the S&L crisis. But we have so many stories of how we were prevented from growing our capital. Now, that was then and this is now. And nothing that happened then should prevent us from investing now. But we do know that there are elders who tell these stories, share these stories, and make people feel like it's not safe. My colleagues on this panel are doing great work in encouraging us to invest and to look differently at our money, which is something we must do. But we must never ignore the history of enslavement and its aftermath and the way that it prevented our accumulation. There were Black men. One more story. And this brother in Mississippi owned 400 acres of what they call arable land. He was all that in a bag of chips. I mean, he's just, when I read about him, I just smile. To make a very long story very short, he sold cottonseed. He was standing in line at a grocery store to sell his cottonseed. The owner offered the white man 95 cents a pound, offered him 85 cents. He said he would rather put his cottonseed in the river than take a lower price. But he didn't say that. He said he would rather put his cottonseed in the damn river than to take a lower price. Now, cursing at a white man was illegal. So they arrested him as he walked out of the store. This brother had so much money that he just reached in his pocket and said, here's my bail. You know, it was $15. Of course, this was 1918.
Yeah, a lot of money.
He ran in his pocket and said, here's my bail. They went and lynched him the next day and held his body. But here's what else they did. They ran him off his land. They ran his family off his land. They took his land. The newspaper described him as an insolent Negro who had too much money. That was the same thing as Black Wall Street when they described Black people as too many N-words, and they did not use the word Negro, too many N-words having too much money. So economic envy often frightened Black people. Richard Wright wrote something in 1935. He said, if there's a lynching in Arkansas, I can feel it in Chicago. And so many of us were intimidated against accumulation because we wanted to live. Now, that's not an excuse today. It's not.
I was about to say, because that was then, this is now. But what's the problem?
But Harold, some of these, just like you talk about, we talk about intergenerational racial memory. Some of this stuff is intergenerational racial memory. I remember once taking my mama to Mississippi. Why did I do that? I had first class tickets. She'd never flown first class. Some white folks thought our seats were their seats. And of course I acted like myself, and you know how that is. And my mother started crying on the plane and said, Julianne, let's just go sit and coach. I'm like, oh, hell no. But she was at that time in her 60s. She was from Mississippi. She was, frankly, she was a race warrior, but she was also afraid of what white people could do. And I don't think that that should take to these generations, but I do think that some of the reluctance about investing, the reluctance about the stock market, other kind of reluctance is partially inherited in terms of what has happened to us when we accumulated. And even today, I remember when Bob Johnson tried to buy US Air. Remember that, Harold? You were around
there. I do. That was a while ago. I do remember.
Yeah. And remember how did they respond? They were not going to let this black man have you. He had the money. He could have bought it, but he was a black man. So even though time passes, racial memory, historical racial memory sits with us. Now, our young people, and I applaud my colleagues for the work they're doing. I really do, guys. I really do applaud you for the work you're doing. But we also have to look at the ways we do financial literacy and financial education and make sure that our young people understand that that was then and this is now. But we also have to gird up because we also have to understand that when the tall nail gets beat down. Imagine that.
But hold on, before you go on, because I've got to get to
Elon Musk was a black man. Just think about that. What if a black man was doing all this stuff, trying to buy Twitter? Just think about it.
LaShawn, some people are interested in generational wealth, not only the concept, but actually working on doing it, while others are more concerned with wealth right now. Can the two coexist or do they conflict?
I think they absolutely can coexist. You can have it now, and there are instruments in the marketplace where I can make sure that my kids are not starting from ground zero. And that's one of the biggest things when creating generational wealth is making sure and ensuring that our kids are not starting from ground zero, but that they have a different experience in life. And so I think it is, well, I know it's possible that you can build it now and live it, enjoy it, and also leave it for the next generation. But Harold, here's what's really important, because statistics show us by the third generation, wealth is lost. And so not only is it important for us to be able to leave a legacy for our kids, but it's also important for them to have a hand in building also and understanding how to continue to make the money grow and not just spend it you know, balling out, going on trips all around the world. Because as, you know, hard as it is for us African-Americans to make it in the marketplace, the third generation can lose it very easily. And so I think it's very important. I do believe the two can coexist, but I think it's important that we teach our kids also the importance of making, multiplying, and preserving wealth.
But why is it, based on the statistic that you just cited, what happens to the third generation? Do they just lose their minds or what?
Yes.
I mean, you know, what happens?
Absolutely. We're not teaching our kids, you know, my own children. My daughter never knew how much we had until one day she started opening up bank accounts. I had her opening up mail. I didn't mean for her to open up that mail, but she did. I think it's really important that we teach our kids, you know, how to be able to use their own utilities to be able to create wealth in their lives also. And so a lot of times we're just not teaching. I mean, we have some friends unexpectedly who passed away, whose kids are left here and literally don't even know how to pay their rent, and they have access to millions of dollars. And so it becomes important that we teach our kids how to be able to handle the wealth that we're leaving them.
So what is that conversation like?
With me? What's the conversation like with me? Absolutely. I mean, literally, I had to sit down and start from ground zero. This is a bank account, and this is how it's used. This is how you pay your bills. Like, unfortunately, they didn't take the time to be able to teach their kid how to be able to continue what he started. And I think it's important. All of my kids work with us in the company. And I think it's really important. You know, it's mandatory. When I have live events, you show up. I'm not just talking just to be talking. I need to make sure that you know what to do with the money that you're going to be left when I leave here. And so people just aren't having those conversations. And it's important to constantly. I can't tell you, Harold, my kids were blessed to go to school with wealthy kids. I can't tell you how many children have come to my house over the years, even as adults, to sit down and say, hey, I don't know how to do this. Can you teach me?
Yeah. Briefly, Dr. Telemark, if I may ask, I only have a few minutes before the break, but I need to get this in with you. What impact do you believe wealth porn, a term that was coined by a colleague of mine, you know, on the Daily Drum, wealth porn, what you see on social media, true or imagined, what impact do you believe that has on African Americans trying to attain wealth? Does it help or does it put them in a hole when they try to keep up with the Joneses?
Yeah, so I would probably say it has a significant impact, just like it would have with, you know, our white counterparts. And would it put us in a hole? I think that anytime you live to keep up with the Joneses, as opposed to make sure that your own family is straight and you are building wealth, you are automatically behind the eight ball. This is probably more of a newer phenomenon with the invention of the smartphone. So now in other apps where you can see instantaneous around the world what some vacation that someone, a Kardashian or whatever, is going on, that you think that you should be going to the Eiffel Tower to rent it out as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Or a Holland, for that matter. Hold on, LaShawn, hold on. I'll let you respond to my little comment. But first, we're going to take a break in just a few moments. Now, during the next half hour, of course, we're going to dive into the complex strategies of investing. Now, before you do, I'd like for each of you to offer a really quick resource, real quick, no comment, website or what have you. Dr. Malveau, no story, just a resource, please. No, we have time later. Go ahead.
Motleyfool.com.
Okay. Dr. Telemach?
Sure. Motley Fool is actually pretty good. Let's go with Morningstar, wealthylearning.com to make it easy for you to see mutual funds.
Okay, wonderful. And LaShawn?
I would probably say Yahoo Finance because I love the variety of options that they actually give you.
Okay, we are going to take a quick station break and say goodbye to our 96.3 WHUR audience. But this conversation continues online and on SiriusXM channel 141 HUR Voices, 96.3 HD2, and on 98.3 FM. Money Talk, eliminating the black-white wealth gap. What's it going to take? We'll continue in just a few seconds.